Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to City Talks. My guest today is Michael Stauffer, Professor of Economic Geography at the LSE, Professor of Economics Sociology at Sciences Po in Paris, and Professor of Urban Planning and Geography at the University of California in Los Angeles. Welcome, Michael. I want to start with, in your book, Keys to the City, you make this case that to really understand cities, we almost have to, we definitely have to take a kind of multidisciplinary approach. Why is that? What's the value of the multidisciplinary approach when we're trying to think about cities?
So the city is the ultimately complex human artifact.
Yeah.
In the sense that it is, it's an embodiment, obviously, of human desire for interaction. Mm-hmm. Right? The core basis of a city is people crowd together on urban land, and you could put it in this way, that they tolerate all kinds of things to be together, right? So they're going to tolerate congestion, noise, high prices, pollution, all the things that we often call negative externalities.
Yeah.
But they get a lot out of it.
Yeah.
So what do they get out of it? We know they get this kind of rich, productive, informational, cultural environment. And you can call it, it makes them rich, it makes them productive, it makes life interesting for some people.
Yeah.
But the point, though, is that in order to do that, they have to do a lot of other things. They have to actually build the city.
Mm-hmm.
So a city isn't just some kind of abstract interaction system, right? It's it's a physical artifact, and you have to set in stone and steel this interaction system to make it work. Bridges, tunnels, housing, etc., etc. So there isn't any one single discipline that could possibly understand all of that, right? You can, I think, come at it from different points of view. An economist will tell you why we do it and it makes us productive and tolerate all of these high prices and all these other things because of the, you know, benefits related to the cost. A sociologist will come and tell you that we become social beings in a different way in the city from how we are social beings in other settings. Mm-hmm. A geographer would say that too. I think a good human geographer and a sociologist would pretty much say the same thing. Mm-hmm. But also a geographer might add the something mysterious about the space of the city itself, sort of like an architect, right? An architect would say, oh yes, but it's a city that I design. The transport engineer would come in with this other perspective. And you could go on and on and on, right? There isn't anyone who has a monopoly on explaining the city and understanding what happens in it, which makes it, I think, really challenging in terms of both sort of the research side and the, we might say, the practical side.
Yeah. And do you think that, what's your sense that, do we have some disciplines that dominate, you know, our understanding, notwithstanding we need to think about them in lots of different ways, losing lots of different disciplines or starting points. Do you have a sense that there are certain disciplines that have historically or contemporary are dominating the understanding of cities or not really? You know, it's an interesting point. Urban economists often say, some urban economists often say, you know, the thinking around cities is being dominated by architects and planners and designers, and they don't fully understand or appreciate the urban economics perspective. And I'm sure, you know, but I don't know. What's your thought on that?
No, I think that for one thing, there's a lot of splits in among the communities who pretend to understand the city. I remember when I started my career, I was in, actually, you said the architects and the planners, but they don't understand each other either.
No, that's
true. I was in a school of architecture and urban planning for a long time, and it was daily conversation that, you know, the planners don't understand design.
Yeah.
And the architects would of course say, oh, well, you know, the planners, they have absolutely no aesthetic sense and all that. They don't get the city as a built object.
Yeah.
And that's just one little split. So I think one is obviously between there's the human sciences, we might say, everything that's kind of social science-y.
Yeah.
There's planning, which is a kind of strange hybrid itself, yeah. right? I mean, are planners social scientists, or are they architect-engineer types?
Yeah.
That's a big split there. Then you have the architects, and of course you also have engineers, who in fact build a lot of the city and its infrastructures. And I mean, I think, for example, over in France, you know, we have this extremely strong engineering tradition, and the prestigious schools, the prestigious schools of planning were actually in engineering schools for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of depends on the country too, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, this now amuses me, right? These kind of differences of perspective, but they're actually pretty hard to overcome.
Yeah, no, they are.
Right?
And in your work, and in many of your papers, particularly some of your more recent work, you've begun to introduce this, or articulate our understanding of cities and why they're successful. And you talk about new economic geography as a sort of discipline, and obviously the urban economics, neoclassical new urban economics, as a slightly related but somewhat different. Just for the uninitiated, can you just unpick some of those and then tell us where they overlap when we're trying to understand what's going on?
So I would say, first of all, that I'm a geographer. I'm trained in economic geography, and I had pretty good training in economics growing up, which is not, I think, always the case among geographers, because a lot of geographers are very sensitive about economics and feel that economics is sort of like cut into our turf, that, you know, we own cities and space, and who are these economists to talk about it? But I do think that economics for a long time had a hard time with the city.
Yeah.
You couldn't fit it into their models. And there has been a revolution, and that urban and regional and spatial economics more generally has been a really exciting field for the last 30 years. And one thing you can say about economists is, they can kind of get off onto their little thing with the model, but oftentimes when they turn their attention to something, they can do it really well.
Yeah.
And so I think they've produced amazing insights. Now, that's where I come in as a geographer, and I'm not looking for just the internal coherence of a model.
Yeah.
Right, which is oftentimes the test that can be applied in economics, right? You look for internal consistency when you do the theory.
Yeah.
You write the equations.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to the empirics, you know, that depends. As some people are better at it than others, we could say. But that's true of any
that's true
of any research field, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we know you can sort of bend whatever numbers you want to tell the story you want to tell. So coming at the city as an economic geographer, you know, I really try to think of it in the kind of widest possible way. And that's where I get to the two branches of the economic revolution, which you asked about.
Yeah.
And we might say that they sort of represent two sides of life. The new neoclassical type branch is really interested in individuals and households seeking to have the best life possible. So it's mostly about things like housing choice, amenity choice, city choice. How do I kind of get the best deal for myself in life?
You know,
what the economist would call, you know, maximizing my utility.
Yeah, utility maximization.
Right?
Yeah.
And I do that because I have all these different preferences.
Yeah.
I want to live in a nice place, but I want to have a good job.
Yeah.
But I want to have parks, but I want to have hipsters. I want to do all these things, and I sort of try to put it together and make the best choice. And this whole school of thought has developed around that, which is very powerful in a way analytically. The idea that what really makes cities and a whole city system are these choices,
mm-hmm.
because they drive migration.
Yeah.
So what they do is they drive the sorting of population among places.
Mm-hmm.
And fundamentally, you know, they're sort of seeing the city as the product of sort of spontaneous desires of people and their families with what they call occasional shocks from the outside world. That's an economist thing, right? Shocks.
Yeah.
Shocks are things like technology changes.
Yeah.
So to give you a story that they told was about how did the American Sun Belt develop? You know, there were millions of people in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, even till today, who flood out of the northern United States into the southern. And the deal there is, according to the story, we gave them air conditioning so they wouldn't suffer in the terrible heat and humidity.
Yeah.
So they could get the best of both worlds, a nice winter without a terrible summer.
Yeah.
And you gave them highways so you could get access. And you gave them cheap housing.
Yeah.
And that somehow unleashed a massive migration away from where they used to live.
Yeah.
Now, arrayed against that kind of story is, I wouldn't say against, but a different perspective is new economic geography.
Yeah.
That's the other major branch, right? And the other major branch really is about jobs.
Yeah.
So its whole sort of entry point is, why do jobs lump or cluster in geographical space?
Yeah.
Why do they pile up in cities like London, which are so expensive?
Yeah.
The land costs are high. Therefore, any firm who locates in a place like London is going to have a huge pass-through.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? You have to pay people for housing, you have to pay for your own land, all that. And fundamentally, the new economic geography is about a tension between jobs that cluster together and jobs that sort of fan out or diffuse.
Yeah.
And the new economic geography came, this is actually, I think, where the big breakthroughs were for economists, because new economic geography came up a way to, came up with a way that is satisfying to hardcore economic theorists to explain why things are so lumpy in geographical space.
Yeah.
Which was a problem for economics.
Yeah.
It wasn't a problem in the real world. Everyone knew this was going on, but there was just no one could write a model for it.
No.
Right? So along came, you know, a bunch of people like Paul Krugman and Jacques Thies and Anthony Venables, and they wrote the models, Fujita. And so now we can do that. So there's actually, in between these two branches of the economics revolution, there are sort of interactions, but also real differences in perspective.
Yeah.
Which is, think about it this way, which tendency is dominating at any one moment? Are people leaving London because they're sick of the high housing costs and they want to go out and get a big garden and a more peaceful neighborhood and maximize their money? Or are they going to crowd into London? Which one of those tendencies dominates?
Yeah.
And the truth is that these two branches of economics don't, I don't think they integrate all that well.
And of course, we'll get on to it, but of course, when you translate and take those issues and ideas and thoughts through, they have quite different policy conclusions or implications, which we'll come back to towards the end, which I think is, you know, which is interesting, some of your thinking on that. But my sense, Mike, I mean, in your book, Keys to the City, and indeed the book you did with Tom and others on LA and San Francisco, you are concerned, this is my interpretation, you're concerned about the pattern of urban economic performance. You know, you think that's a problem. Just give a sense as to why you are, what's the pattern and why are you concerned about it?
It's the problem that concerns me most at the present time. And actually, let me sort of make a reference back to these theory duels or debates. Yeah. The people, the sort of that first branch of urban economics, the sort of more neoclassical, more consumer and household oriented part, they actually have a really strong statement. They say the only thing we should look at is population growth.
Yeah.
Because people vote with their feet. So in other words, if a city is gaining people, we know that it's successful because it attracts people. And if it's not, it's in trouble.
Yeah.
I don't think that's right.
Okay.
I think that income is at least as important and perhaps more important an indicator of urban economic success. When I say income, I mean per capita income.
Yeah.
And there are little sort of bells and whistles we could put on that. But fundamentally, I want to know whether a city is prosperous or not.
Yeah.
So, and we know that we have cities that are not so much in Britain, but again, take the North American case, you have cities that are gaining millions of people, but they're actually not offering them such a great quality of life.
Yeah.
In the sense that the kinds of employment that people find there are, to my mind, not that great.
Yeah.
You have, so there's all kinds of cases out there. If we take an urban system, you could find examples of cities that are gaining people and have high levels of income and productivity growth. You could find cities that are growing with low levels of income and productivity growth or even decline. You can find cities that are declining with people but doing okay on income and productivity. You can find cities that are losing people and doing poorly on income. So I'm not sure why. I don't believe that the population variable is the only indicator of success or failure.
Yeah.
And the question then, and that gets us back to the jobs question.
Yeah.
That side of the thinking.
Yeah.
So how do people and jobs interact over geographical space? Now the first school of thought will come back and respond, and they'll say, the bottom line is you think they're doing poorly in the places with low income, but actually they're doing well because their housing's cheap.
Yeah.
So their utility is fine, and we shouldn't worry about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't buy that. So I don't buy it. I don't think the numbers show that. So
yeah.
It's a big dispute that I have with that school of thought. I don't think the numbers show it.
Yeah.
And I would say that even if the numbers did show that, say, some city is gaining people, it has cheap housing, but not so great jobs, would that be okay? My answer would be no, not in this world. It's not okay.
Yeah.
Right? Because in the long run, especially in any developed country, if you don't develop high quality jobs, no amount of cheap housing and amenities will actually give people a satisfactory life anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't believe in that method of calculating people's welfare.
Yeah.
And that would put me in serious opposition to a lot of hardcore economists.
So when you look out and you see, and you're thinking about these a kind of jobs first perspective, I think in many respects, or at least we need to think about how, in your words, we have to think about how places generate income rather than necessarily spend that income. I think my crude, sort of difference. The patterns that you see when you look at how different places are successful or otherwise on that income front, what's the concern? In a sense, I think you're one where you're very clearly that some cities are in different clubs. Some are doing very well. Some are doing not so well. And you think, you're clear that the difference between these places is getting wider rather than necessarily getting narrower. Is that right? What's the concern there when we think about that economic performance?
So I think there we get where we're also starting to touch on a really important policy debate today, which is what are the components of giving people a good or satisfactory life in different kinds of places. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we should admit that yes, there are different ways one can come up with a good life. Mm-hmm. So the sort of the consumer housing household choice school of thought, they actually have, I think, a really strong point in saying that not everybody wants to live in central London, wants to have a high power job, a super expensive apartment that takes away a lot of their high income.
Yeah.
Lots of people are happier with a different package.
Yeah.
So that's not a problem. I think that's one interesting thing about geographical space is it mirrors something about the diversity of the society itself. Mm-hmm. Different ways to live in different places.
Yeah.
Right? And that's fine. It's that though that when we look today, I think concretely, and we see a lot of the places that are cheaper in housing terms and so on, they're mostly cheaper in housing terms because they're not doing that well on the employment side. Right? Now that's not true so much at the intra-metropolitan scale.
Okay.
Meaning, take a vast metropolitan area like the southeast of England.
Yeah.
Right. Greater London.
Yeah.
And there, yeah, we do have all kinds of packages
yeah.
that people, you know, some people live far out, they have more transport time, but they get a bigger house,
yeah.
they get access to the London employment market and so on. And that's because they're in the greater London labor market where the job opportunity, the income opportunity yeah. exist.
Yeah.
And then what they do is they optimize or arbitrage according to their needs for, you know, how many bedrooms
yeah.
or whether they want a garden or their lifestyle. That's fine. But when you talk about, say, London versus the rest of Britain,
yeah.
where the labor markets are not connected,
yeah.
then what we're talking about is people going somewhere else where fundamentally the kinds of income
moment.
And it's not just in at one moment, it's the opportunity to develop their skills
yeah,
and
yeah.
human capacities
yeah.
are different.
Yeah.
And if someone argues to me, as many economists do, well, that's okay because their housing is cheaper, or you know, there are you know lower costs for a lot of other kinds of services, I don't think the numbers show that, and it doesn't even appeal to me as a kind of a model of human behavior.
Yeah, yeah. And is that because, I mean, you said earlier on that you know you're ultimately thinking about how places and people are generating the income, and you know you want to think about how different places create environments for doing that. One of the concerns is that you know people in different places, they may have a cheap housing, but if their earning power is somewhat diminished, that has knock-on spillover effects for the economy at large, because we're not getting productivity out of them, we're not getting innovation out of them, we're not getting entrepreneurialism out of them in the same way. Is that some of your concerns?
Yeah, and I could say, you know, that their human growth opportunities
yes.
are lower in those kinds of environments. Mm. No matter whether you can, you know, I can, you know, sure, we could do the numbers, and it might be true that they're making a lower salary, their housing's cheaper, and in the end, you know, the net sort of cost of living and benefit they get is just as good as for someone in some part of London.
Yeah.
But you have to look at it in terms of, and this is, I think, where the sort of the non-economist, the kind of broader social scientist comes up.
Yeah.
You have to look at it in terms of sort of human growth opportunities.
Yeah.
Right? It's not just having a good sort of like a good optimization for today. It's where do you live? What does that mean for you across the course of your life and maybe, you know, maybe your family's life in terms of what you're going to become? And that's where this kind of logic of, oh, well, it's great, you know, all these cheap places. Sure, now look, for retirees, that works, right? That's fine. They've done their life. They have their money, and they can very easily say, you know, no, I don't need to live in central London. It's too expensive and noisy anyway. I'll take my money and optimize.
Yeah.
But that's a special case. The real case is the places are about income, they're about amenities, or about housing, but they're also about human growth, opportunity,
yeah, yeah.
and learning.
Yeah. And is it your sense that there are fewer, because of the agglomeration gains that we see in places like London or San Francisco or New York or, you know, these sorts of places, Paris, etc., that you get the difference between those places and the rest is ever widening, and therefore the growth opportunities, human or otherwise, in other places are diminished?
Yes.
Is that your...
Yes. This is the big problem today.
Okay, right.
So I think that the problem that really I'm most interested in as a scholar, but also in terms of society and politics
yeah.
and policy, is this intercity or interregional divergence in real incomes, but also real opportunities.
Yeah.
We're seeing a widening gap between a set of mostly big, but not entirely, successful city regions and a set of regions and even other metropolitan areas that are less successful
mm-hmm.
at real income and at opportunity creation.
Yeah.
And that, as we know, is having spillovers into politics.
Yeah.
It's in the news every day. It's about Brexit. It's about the election of Donald Trump. It's
yeah.
about tensions in almost every country between not only the people who are considered to be the sort of winners from globalization, but their places
yeah.
against these others
yeah.
where there's a feeling of, widening gaps and increasingly separate worlds.
Yeah.
Separate worlds of opportunity, of learning, of skills, and so on.
Yeah.
And less migration between them.
Yeah.
That's the other.
No, of course, yeah. That is
a very, very.
That is an important point, isn't it?
Yeah.
That sort of diffusion issue, either on the jobs front or on the people front, seems to be lessening over time rather than not.
So we used to have, in maybe several decades ago, most developed countries had some combination of these two sort of evening out mechanisms. One is that over time, jobs would sort of mature and they would diffuse out from the metropoles into the other places and provide employment and usually good employment.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that people would move up to opportunity. So ambitious people from any region could get an education and go to whatever were the hot spots of the day.
Yeah.
The kind of what London would be today.
Yeah.
But those mechanisms have both slowed down.
Yeah.
So it's harder for people who grow up in the lower income areas to break into London. And there's a lot of reasons for that we're trying to understand.
Yeah.
But also the jobs that would have diffused outward from London to say other areas of England or Britain, now they just go to the
they go to India or they go to China.
Right.
Or
so they jump over these other regions.
Yeah.
So we're now in a period where those adjustment mechanisms and the kind of opportunity sharing mechanisms are not as strong.
Yeah. No, that is that's a great insight in terms of the, I think, the diffusion element both ways actually is a very hot issue. I want to get your thoughts on, because you're talking about, and you talk about city success, what makes them successful and such, and you obviously, because you're drawing on lots of different disciplines, but also you're alive to it and writing and talking about lots of different factors. I just want to pick up two and get your thoughts on it. The first one is, you think the specialization is a kind of factor and a driver in the positioning ultimately of urban areas in the system. Mm-hmm. And then the second factor, which I'd like you to get some thoughts on, is, and you spend quite a bit of time talking about institutions, both formal and informal, around the role that they play in networks as well. So, but just start with, what's the role and the way that specialization is the motor or driver of this differentiation between different places within the same urban system?
Well, so specialization, all we're doing really is channeling, Adam Smith and David Ricardo in some sense, which is, that the modern economy is this astonishing kind of mechanism built around division of labor. And in geography, that simply means that, different kinds of activities can sort of go to different places. And that's the new economic geography, which gives us all these tools to understand this clustering and specialization mechanism. So we live, and we live in this economy where specialization is, for cities, is actually more possible than ever before, because the downside of specialization, which is getting your goods and services to some faraway consumer, has sort of been erased by lower transport costs.
Yeah.
So cities are specialized. It doesn't mean they specialize in one thing. A city region like London is what we might call multiply specialized.
Yeah.
Some people, there's a confusion about that, because some people say London's diversified.
Yeah.
I actually think that's not exactly the right way to get it. I think London just it's big enough to have a lot of different specializations. They might actually also kind of help each other in certain ways, like having the arts and media and politics all in one city. Those are three different industries, but clearly they sort of build on one another, right? Because you need all the chatty media kind of people to do them, right? So, or you could say that, some cities have different kinds of tech. London obviously has an array of things related to finance.
Yeah.
So specialization, as we know, has these amazing productivity advantages.
Yeah.
And now, however, all specializations are not the same.
Yeah.
So this is where I think the other part of the story comes in. It's not enough just to be specialized. it's better to be specialized in something high wage than something low wage.
Yeah.
So specialization is a kind of like a natural basis for a city economy today. Mm-hmm. But there's a hierarchy.
Yeah.
And that actually leads to that second issue you raised about institutions.
Yeah.
So when a bunch of us did this book on Los Angeles and San Francisco, we took these two cities that were actually when we looked at them from 1970 onward.
Yeah.
In 1970, these are two city regions that are both highly successful. We're not taking sort of like rich cities and poor cities. It's more like taking cities in the kind of the upper crust of the of the city world.
Yeah.
And what happens is that their specializations evolve, but they evolve more favorably for San Francisco than for LA. The new economy comes along. The new economy is finance and media and high tech and health sciences and, you know, all the kind of propulsive industries of the developed world today. LA had a lot of these in its day. It was a high-tech city for its day. It had aerospace and a lot of engineering works and so on. But when the technology shock comes along and we turn to the digital age, San Francisco wins the sweepstakes.
Yeah.
It becomes Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Right? It's the world center of high-tech. And LA doesn't, even though they had pretty similar starting points.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting thing if you think about cities over time. It's not just at one point in time, but as the economy changes, what is it about certain cities that enables them to sort of capture, reinvent themselves? I think that's a term actually that was used in a Center of City report, wonderful report on 1913 to 100 years, which I thought was really, really wonderful in the way that it was trying to capture these cities that could reinvent versus cities that kind of kept on doing the same old thing while the world changed around them.
Yes.
And there's a bit of that in the LA-San Francisco story. And we sought to understand why.
Yeah.
What is it what stands out? Because in LA's case, there's a lot of advantage. A lot of smart people, nice climate, a few very dynamic industries, notably Hollywood, which is the entertainment industry and is now coming back in LA, by the way. So that's really nice because the new age of television, LA is getting it all.
Okay,
all your Netflix things are now being made in LA.
Oh, that's
so that's the good story.
Yeah.
But but what was different, we found, is that San Francisco had deeper, wider, more interconnected civic networks. Not only the kind of typical sort of, you know, leadership, like, you know, heads of major companies and politicians, but also sort of into communities were better structured. They related to each other better. They different kinds of communities connected better. And as a result, early on in the age of IT, and I'm talking 1980s, what happened was that these communities were able to bring the different pre-existing talents of the metropolitan area together and help them to become leaders, inventors. LA had much more segmented communities. The engineers never talked to people in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Right? So what happened in the Bay Area is that these different communities talked to one another. Another thing is that they got their storyline right.
Yeah.
Already by the 1980s, people in the Bay Area said, we're expensive.
Yeah.
We have to be innovative.
Yeah.
In LA, they kept on looking backward and saying, you know, we'll make it, we'll go back to the golden age of, you know, when we were a big manufacturing center. So if you get the story wrong, and if there's no networks that can really sort of put the new ideas together and cause the storyline to change, then what happens is the policymakers get fed the wrong advice.
Yeah.
Backward looking versus forward looking.
I think that book is a fantastic book, and it's probably one of the only urban economics sort of books I've read that reads a little bit like a detective story as well, in the sense of the way that you structure it. I won't go into more detail, listeners. You should read it, and then you'll know what I'm talking about. But your point about not only having the networks, the quality, the breadth, the interrelatedness, the difference, but actually how they view the world, and in the LA looking back to the, you know, to the port and to the past rather than necessarily looking forward. I thought that was a, you know, great insight. And it's a particularly great insight because many of our UK cities, but cities elsewhere, are still in that, can we recapture the glories of the past, whatever that might be, rather than how do we prepare ourselves and our firms and our people for, you know, for the future, which is, you know, which is, I think, unfortunately, many don't really do that sufficiently well. They have a go at it, but they're not consistently kind of keeping going on that. Mike, I want to just, there's so much we could talk about, but I just want to get your reflections on what does this mean for policy? I know you know, in the city, in the keys of the city, you very admirably at the end write, you know, a kind of 4 or 5 pager as a, you know, a letter to the policy maker, which I found admirable. So many academics do not worry about or worry less about the policy implications. But you know, on the sort of things that you've been talking about, what does that mean for policy, and how should policymakers at the national, at the local, at the supranational, you've done lots of work at the European Union level as well, which is fascinating stuff. What does it mean? What can they take away from it? What can they be doing?
Well, this is, of course, an immense, that's a huge field. There are, I think, many fronts, yeah, of on this this policy effort or, yeah, battle today. Yeah. But let me sort of signal I think what is a main line of debate about policy.
Okay.
That's emerged in almost every country, and in some ways it reflects those differences in the researcher or theory approaches.
Yeah.
One line is very much centered on housing.
Yeah.
So, and I think everyone agrees that housing's a problem. Housing's a problem in two senses. One is that if you take cities like London, the housing is, well, first of all, it's very expensive for people who are already here.
Yeah.
But I think it's now well admitted that, let's say you are one of those people who would like into the London opportunity system, but you're not living there already, that the difference in housing costs is probably a barrier to mobility.
Yeah.
And more so, this has always been the case, but much more so today, we can measure it,
yeah,
that the multiple is much greater today than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So something about this economic cycle has accelerated that difference. It's also a problem internally, right? The problem internally is about, on the one hand, it's gentrification for certain communities and their feelings of being buffeted around and dislocated.
Yeah.
I think it's also the feeling of getting adequate housing relative to wages, even in extremely prosperous metropolitan areas like London.
Yeah.
So housing's a big deal these days.
Yeah.
Now, the question is it kind of like the miracle solution to all of our problems? And there's a whole bunch of economics papers that sort of go in that direction.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they really say that, but but if you strip it down and say, what's the bottom line for you? And these are, you know, friends and colleagues,
yeah,
with whom I have friendly debate.
Yeah.
They will say that the problem of both the growth of major metropolitan areas, but also the problem of this interregional divergence and the stagnation of opportunity and all the frustrations in the other places is that we live in a NIMBY world.
Yeah.
And the NIMBYs are not allowing the system to function efficiently.
Yeah.
So I think there's some truth to that. But there's not a counterfactual under which,
no,
if all of a sudden tomorrow we said there are no more planning controls in London or Paris or New York or San Francisco,
yeah,
and we build a bunch of new housing, is all of a sudden the problem of divergence and the difference in opportunity between people and regions going to disappear? The answer is clearly no.
No.
There's a job problem.
Yeah.
The job problem is that in not everybody, even if London had cheaper housing, not everyone wants to move here.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. This is just not a reasonable statement about the world.
Yeah.
And not every Texan wants to go to New York. So, and not everyone in the southeast or southwest of France wants to move to Paris. So the problem is that maybe some of them would move, but we actually have, a deeper problem, which is the geography of jobs.
Yeah.
And the good jobs are going to mostly the major metropolitan areas and a few other kind of boutique-y yeah. success cases like Cambridge.
Yeah.
Right. And you've got now a geography of jobs which doesn't assign a clear role to a lot of our regions.
Yeah. And what can we do about that? I mean, I completely and utterly agree with your diagnosis of, you know, the issue. And, you know, so much of our thinking is about, you know, is about the geography of jobs, and that creates some problems. And yet when we turn to our, you know, we turn to our policy responses,
yeah.
it's very difficult to shift jobs, certainly to shift jobs from one place to another, notwithstanding we might get, you know, job growth outside of different places. But it's a real difficult policy response. I mean, give us your best, you know, what's your best shot on this?
So this is actually, this is a subject I've been working on with two colleagues at LSE, Simona Iamarino and Andres Rodriguez-Pose.
Yeah.
And we've been trying to think about this in the context of the European Union.
Yeah.
And actually in countries like Britain
yeah.
and the European Union, I don't mean to, yeah.
No.
So what we have, but this is also actually across the developed world, we have a lot of regions that are in what we call the middle income trap.
Mm-hmm.
They're neither innovative enough to be like the Londons or Cambridges of the world, but they're not cheap enough to compete with developing countries
yeah.
or even with Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
So these places that were sort of, you know, naturally the areas of diffusion of jobs in the great post-war period of the 20th century,
yeah.
they're not anymore.
Yeah.
We've had all these formulas for them. You know, we're going to make them all high tech,
yeah.
and we're going to make, you know, put universities everywhere and get everyone a university degree and
yeah.
all that. And I think we've all now come around to the notion that kind of one size fits all, that, you know, like the Lisbon agenda of the European Union, every place will be a high-tech
yeah,
region.
Yeah.
Well, this is not true.
Yeah.
This isn't going to happen.
No.
It's not even realistic.
No.
Rather, what we have to do is think about different starting points.
Yeah.
What are the policy objectives for London are not going to be the policy objectives for other cities and regions
yeah.
in Britain,
yeah.
for example.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean? It means thinking about what the starting points are that are realistic. Now, there are some basics you still have to do for all regions. One is they have to have good institutions.
Yeah.
And a lot of regions have bad institutions.
Yeah.
Britain has pretty good institutions everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a high state capacity, low corruption country.
Yeah.
Parts of Europe don't, though.
Do not,
right?
Course.
There's a lot of parts
yeah.
of Europe that have high corruption and low state capacity.
Yeah.
So you got to fix that,
yeah.
right? Building roads is not going to work.
Yeah.
Because actually connectivity today is a double-edged sword,
yeah.
right? When you build connectivity, oftentimes it just reinforces the clustering
yeah,
effect,
yeah.
which we've learned the hard way
yeah.
in a lot of countries.
Many people have not learned that yet at
right.
all.
We're still spending money on, you know, I mean, it's fine, you know, like I love our fast train system in France because it gets me to my holidays faster.
Yeah.
But it doesn't actually, as I've pointed out in France, it has not actually spread development to the French provinces.
Yeah.
In fact, what it's done is reinforced the position of Paris,
yeah.
which is stronger than ever in per capita income terms and proportion of national output, right? So TGV has had actually a centralizing effect, and we have to understand that and be realistic about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Then there's the question, I think, of education and training, where the university for everybody model,
yeah.
where I think lots of people are talking about that, but we now know that it was kind of a nice idea because it corresponds to sort of a, you know, egalitarian ideal of all that. I mean, of course, I think universities should actually be located in lots of places. But the idea that every place will have an equal emphasis on university education is probably not realistic.
No.
There are other kinds of skills.
Yeah.
hate to sound corny, but entrepreneurship's a really big issue these days, and we haven't solved it. No. Here in Britain, Margaret Thatcher talked about it a lot, and did all those kind of incentives for everyone to become an entrepreneur. And you may recall that what we found was that after all the incentives had been provided, that many entrepreneurs, when they were interviewed by anthropologists and sociologists, they said, well, the thing is that after my first venture failed, no one would ever give me a loan again.
Yeah.
Right? Which is the difference between Britain and America.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
In Silicon Valley, it's a badge of honor.
Yeah. How many times have you failed?
But that's institutional. Yeah. It's not cultural.
No.
Right? We have the same problem in France.
Yeah.
Right? You fail once, you'll never get a loan again.
Yeah.
So you have to actually get into reforming the conditions for success. So there's actually no one size fits all. And what Simona and Andres and I are arguing for is what we call distributed development policies, meaning we cannot accept this idea that the Londons of the world will get everything.
Yeah.
That's intolerable politically and economically, because
yeah.
everyone won't migrate. But that how are we going to do it is through, you have to have kind of a place-sensitive strategy for each different kind or club of region.
Yeah.
You have to assess the starting points. But institutions, entrepreneurship, education, and a realistic set of what are the activities that could be captured for that region.
I was going to ask you, is
a starting point, the specialization question.
Yeah, and I suppose are you optimistic that, particularly, I guess, those cities in that middle bracket, the kind of middle income trap, as you call it, are you confident that they can move in the right direction? Do you, in a sense, from a policy point of view, do we have sufficient feel and knowledge about the policy? I mean, the policies that you were just articulating, and then we can allow these places to move from where they currently are, which is kind of no man's land in some respect, I think.
I think you're exactly right. To be honest about it, I think we haven't done that well.
Yeah.
And that we need a thorough rethinking in every country that I can think of, a thorough rethinking of sort of, what we might call regional policy issues. We have this kind of old toolkit. A lot of it's based on euphemisms.
Yeah.
And there's a very strong lobby in favor of it. Mm-hmm. There are interests that are in that have been set up that are in favor of it, and we are actually not succeeding, right? Because if we were succeeding, inter-regional income divergence wouldn't be growing. So we have to now really be honest, and we have to understand that it's a bit of a crisis.
Yeah.
Because people are angry in a lot of regions,
yeah.
and in a way, rightfully so.
Yeah.
They were told that the age of new technologies and skills and education and globalization would be shared prosperity for everyone.
Yeah.
And it hasn't turned out to be the case.
Yeah.
Neither in between different groups of people. I mean, there's growing income inequality. I consider that a problem.
Yeah.
But there's also, it takes this regional form that's particularly dramatic. So, no, we don't exactly know what to do.
Yeah.
And we've got to get really serious. So now let's talk about the optimistic side
yeah.
of it, though.
We'll finish on a good one, on a positive note.
There are places that I think there. What we need to do is have a much more sort of rigorous research over large sets of cases of A, the places that have succeeded in reinvention.
Yeah.
And there are some of those.
Yeah.
And so we need to really dig in to those cases and try to lock down what are the essential elements of their experience. I think institutions are absolutely central to that. That I think what you will find across those experiences mm-hmm. is that there are different things about education levels and infrastructure and connectedness, the hard factors, but the soft thing is going to be the institutions and what we mentioned a few minutes ago, which is getting people aligned to tell the right story about the past and the future, and to not tell the wrong story that looks backward. So I think there, and then the other thing we should look at is, so those are, we might say, places that reinvent, but also there are up and coming places, places that have succeeded who weren't rich in the past, but that have recently become so.
Yeah.
And less so in Europe. There's a lot of that in America, which has this kind of big turnover in its system. If you take the south of America, you know, about half of it is places that are sort of like in this middle income stagnation. And then some of it's places that have been pretty good in the last 40, 50 years and going from being pretty poor to being pretty rich.
Yeah.
So we really need to get that story of elements of success and failure and use it to reinvent regional policy.
My guest today has been Professor Michael Stolper. Michael, thanks for being part of City Talks.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Center for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Center for Cities. Please rate, review, and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Center on Twitter at Center for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Center is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centerforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. Used with permission, and all rights are reserved.